It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
With the coronavirus pandemic, the National Folk Festival will be offering up a virtual event on September 12th and 13th. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Pandemic has shut down many events this year, and so it is with the National Folk Festival, at least the in-person kind. Today, the festival will be launching a virtual display of past and original recordings on Delmarva Public Media and its social media websites. Last year drew more than 150,000 attendees and over 350 artists featured at seven outdoor stages. But concern over the virus has moved the festival to the virtual world. Talk about what led up to this decision and what to expect. We have on the phone with us Laura Bottinelli, the executive director of the National Council for the Traditional Arts. And welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Don.
So why don't you start first with how this decision came about? Obviously, a lot of other folks have come to the same decision with their own events, but give me some sense about when you guys finally decided you couldn't go through with at least the in-person form of this.
Well, this is going back a little earlier in 2020. You know, in March, we all found ourselves in quarantine and quickly began to realize that the forecast for 2020 was not going to be ideal for getting 150,000 people together. And so by the end of April, we had made our public announcement. The National Folk Festival leadership team had gotten together and weighed all the pros and cons of trying to proceed with what we knew at that time with an in-person gathering. And it was clear for a number of reasons that suspending those plans for 2020 was the best route. So that way, potentially, we could celebrate the 80th National Folk Festival together in 2021. And so since we've done that at the end of April, we've been pivoting to coming up with this virtual celebration. And I know that's what we're going to talk a little bit more about today.
So as a matter of fact, how did the idea of constructing this virtual event come about? And what kind of platforms are we looking at? What kind of audience do you think there's going to be?
So, yeah, it's been all summer long, it's really been evolving. We've watched a number of our peer festivals put together virtual festival performances using radio, other online platforms. So we've had the benefit of seeing a few of these go through very successfully with some of our partner festivals. And so as we were looking ahead to September, we know we wanted to leverage our very strong social media presence that the National Folk Festival enjoyed in its 2 years in Salisbury. And then, of course, using the public radio platform through your institution to be able to do some broadcasts of past performances over your radio airwaves. So the online experience will be very interactive. It's going to have a rich variety of new content, which we can talk about. And as you know, on Delmarva Public Media, on Saturday and Sunday from 12 to 3, we'll be rebroadcasting some of the performances from the past National Folk Festivals in Salisbury, including commentary and interviews with Nick Spitzer of American Roots, and some of the past festival performers. So it's really going to be a robust dual-platform experience with the public radio and with the online social experience.
By the way, how is your old stomping grounds, the Ward Museum, going to be involved in all of this?
Oh, well, they actually have been leading the pack with some of the digital programming related to the National Folk Festival. Your listeners have been listening to Chesapeake Traditions Today, a weekly series that has been spotlighting tradition bearers from the Eastern Shore, many of them who were featured in the year one of our National Folk Festival in Salisbury in the Chesapeake Traditions program. So we heard from, you know, oyster shuckers, Smith Island cake makers, the Nassauwawash Band of Indians, and other tradition bearers of the shore through that program. So that radio program your listeners have been enjoying, there are now video vignettes that are available for each of those tradition bearers, and they will be featured on Saturday during the online stream on our Facebook page and on nationalfolkfestival.com. And so we feel that's a really important way to bring the local culture into what is going to be basically a national showcase of traditional arts and culture through the National Folk Festival.
And also you indicate there's going to be some kind of family activities. What's that about?
Yes. As you know, the National Folk Festival, we have many different ways to engage our public. And so, for example, the Red Trouser Show, which was a juggling and performance group, they put together a special family area activity that will air for us on, I believe, September 12th. And then a few of our local presenting organizations will have other family area activities tucked into the stream during the weekend. All of those activities and the schedule will be published basically by the minute next week, the week of the festival. So that way, if you are looking to specifically focus in on the family area activities or there's a particular artist that you want to make sure you don't miss, you will be able to kind of have almost a minute-by-minute layout of what will come through that stream over the weekend.
And I guess you have, I mean, some of the acts that I think I've seen listed as, I think it's bluegrass, Creole jazz, that kind of thing. Give us a sense about the variety that you're looking at and how you decide which ones to sort of bring back, because you have a whole host of them over the last couple of years.
So, well, designing the programming for the virtual festival, you know, we were sensitive to that, you know, when we did cancel for 2020, that we were already booked with artists who we hope to be able to showcase in person in 21. We had a number of other activities that we were sort of pivoting and rescheduling some of our artist engagements. And then, of course, those artists that do speak to a lot of the interests of Salisbury. So who's coming forward for the virtual celebration is also matches what we've seen with our artists and who's been doing a lot of virtual activities successfully. You know, it is a very hard and creative pivot that these artists have had to make in order to present themselves well and strong in a virtual format. So our selections were sensitive to a variety of those issues. But for instance, Los Llaneros de la 21, who is a Bamba y Plena group from New York, have been doing some really impressive engagements virtually. There'll be a first-time view for many of our Salisbury viewership. The Fidel Band, which is an Ethiopian jazz-based ensemble based in Washington, D.C. It'll be the first time that our National Folk Festival viewers in Salisbury will meet them. But then old favorites like people who enjoyed Hot Club of Cowtown last year in person will be doing a performance with us. And Jerry Douglas, the master dobro player from Nashville, Tennessee, will be making a performance. So it's really a wide variety of traditional arts and culture bearers. And I'm trying to find something that kind of speaks to, of course, this very the richness and variety of American culture, which is the goal of the National Folk Festival, is to really give a lens into many of the rich cultural communities throughout the United States. And we think we have pulled that off with what you're going to experience in the virtual celebration.
Now, I understand, by the way, you have a documentary on the 80-year history of the festival. Describe a little bit about that, but did you learn something from that as well?
Well, you know, when we went into 2020 for the 80th planning, that was planned as a retrospective documentary. And what we've decided to do is really it's a sneak peek, a preview to what will be published as a full documentary in 21. We're focusing on the National Folk Festival experience in Salisbury with that about 15-minute documentary program. And you'll hear voices from the Salisbury community speaking about the impact of the festival experience and how it's been transformative and the way that it's able to create these moments of social cohesion and understanding and transmission. So when we think about that documentary, I just want our listeners and viewers to know that it's a preamble to when we come together for the 80th and us publishing the documentary about the full scope of the history of the National. But in putting that documentary together, and one of the reasons we held back on leaning into publishing the full piece, is that what we're going to experience between 2020 and 2021 for the National Folk Festival, for the city of Salisbury, for all the United States, is going to be a really transformative year when we think about how communities get together, how these events are important to our social fabric, and with the continuing challenges of coronavirus, what does our experience in 2021 look like? We have the additional factor for Salisbury with Mayor Day being deployed on active duty and away from the community for the majority of 2020. And, you know, our optimism that 21, when we're all gathering together in person, Mayor Day will be back in Salisbury. So that aspect of the storyline for the national, obviously nothing like that has happened before either. So we feel as though pulling that whole story together for the documentary in September of 21 will be a very important punctuation, not only for the city of Salisbury, but for the National Folk Festival and its future.
By the way, speaking of the documentary, was there anything about it that you learned about the festival that perhaps you didn't know before? I mean, I guess you've been in the job for about a year or so. What's anything that strikes you about the character of this festival?
Well, I continue in my experience with NCTA, the National Council for the Traditional Arts, to be just really honored and deeply moved by how generous everyone is in sharing their cultural perspectives in an effort to create a better understanding of the complexities of our diverse communities and how seeing and knowing one another is ultimately creating a much more healthy and inclusive picture of American culture. And so our tradition bearers and artists as ambassadors of their cultural communities, and then for our host community of Salisbury, how welcoming and how deep those interactions have been, and how it basically has shaped our years to come in the way that we honor and create inclusive and equitable arts experiences both locally and nationally.
By the way, how do you see this festival fitting into the times we live in? I think I saw a quote from you which said that essentially that the festival celebrates what we have in common, not what separates us. It is building trust and understanding while connecting us to the past as well as to the future. What significance do you attach to this festival, particularly in these very difficult times?
Well, I mean, what is shared is at the heart of what the National Folk Festival tries to do. I mean, the cultural communities that we work with are so diverse and complex, and the cultural traditions of the millions of American people who are stewarding their traditions and their connections to their personal identity, their community identity, and how they see themselves as part of a broader public. It's going to play a central role in the future health of American communities. We know that stewarding and sustaining traditions is a way for people to not only connect themselves to one another, to themselves in the future, but then also to be able to meet people and understand how their cultural background has informed their life and trajectory, and that these things can be complementary and enriching and deepening to all of us as we find a way forward. It is an extremely challenging time in American culture, and we find that showcasing these cultures and understanding the hearts of the American people in its very diverse and beautiful forms is one way for people to see each other and build a better understanding.
Now, this will be actually the third year that the festival has been in Salisbury, although it won't be physically here, and we'll have another year next year. What kind of impact do you see this festival having on the region?
Well, we already know that the two in-person years, and speaking just to 2019, you know, the $46 million long-term economic impact that the in-person event had was obviously substantial. And as we think about the virtual celebration and looking ahead to 21, you know, as the city of Salisbury, you know, is reopening and, you know, beginning to have smaller engagements over potentially the course of 2020 and 21, you know, having the economic impacts that come from that type of activity, it will be so important for that to become another a regular part of the economic future of the city, and how the National Folk Festival plays into that and the scope and visibility of that engagement. We would hope it's playing a similar role as it had done in its first 2 years. But again, cultural cohesion that happens, the big lift that the community does in order to make an event like this successful, is very unifying and healing, and the can-do attitude. So not to speak too much on how your community is facing and recovering and responding to the challenges that has been facing it. But I've been so impressed by the tenacity and transparency and communications that the city has shared with its residents and the wider community. So the collective efforts to be able to do something like the National Folk Festival again in 21, I'm optimistic that we will be able to design it in a way where it has as many healthy outcomes as possible for the community. And those, you know, healthy outcomes are on multiple levels, whether it's, you know, economic, social, cultural, and then, of course, just, you know, the basics of keeping visitors safe. We won't make plans for the 21 festival until at least early in 21 to figure out what the scope of what we're doing is. There is just too much uncertainty right now about how these large mass gatherings will come back into the fold, not only in Salisbury, but within the nation and in performing arts. So we're on a wait and see to see what will really be offered in 21, but we hope it will be able to continue to, again, have those healthy impacts that I was just talking about.
What was some of the major challenges to putting together this this virtual version of the National Folk Festival?
Well, you know, I'll speak to the example of one of our partner organizations, the Maryland State Arts Council and Maryland Traditions. Every year we showcase the master apprenticeship teams from the State Folklife Program on site at the National Folk Festival. And so this year, in order to showcase those master apprenticeship teams, they all had to be filmed virtually. All of the artists did self-documentation, interviews through Zoom, and then they've been knitted together into these, you know, 7-minute vignettes that are trying to capture, you know, the depth of that that master artist team and their tradition that they're stewarding. And being able to produce those types of high quality of virtual format media productions in such a short time frame, and knowing that the technologies of many of our tradition bearers is varied, you know, the access to, you know, broadband and internet, not only other types of high-quality technology, it is a struggle. And we know that residents are facing this now, whether they're dealing with virtual school or their own personal experiences. But for artists now, looking as these screens being one of their only way to deliver, you know, their life's work, and overcoming those technical challenges has been a part of our entire experience with the virtual celebration. And we've been successful in supporting the artists to be able to present them best selves in the virtual celebration. But that will continue to be a struggle as it is now. The longer that we are relying solely on these virtual platforms to deliver the depth and variety of traditional culture that we present at the National.
Do you think, by the way, that this experience with the virtual world is going to change or add to what you may do, say, in the years coming in terms of not only reaching out to the people, obviously, who come to the festival and so on, and, of course, we broadcast it on our radio stations and other media outlets, but it seems to me that, like many institutions, not only in terms of them adapting to this virtual world, but they're actually finding ways to communicate and expand their presence in terms of an audience.
Well, absolutely. You know, the National Folk Festival, the National Council for the Traditional Arts, we have been highly reliant on the in-person experience as a way to share the depths of what we're presenting. And having that completely removed and turning solely to a virtual presentation has made us realize that there is an aspect of that engagement that we can incorporate into the future, even if we are coming together. It has also allowed us to tap our archives here much more deliberately, because the National Council for the Traditional Arts Archives, I mean, it has materials that go back to the 30s. We've been recording our festival experiences consistently since the late 50s. And so knowing that those materials are available and of interest and can add to the understanding of the in-person activities that we're presenting potentially in the future, it definitely has opened our eyes to a way to engage and cultivate audience and communities that will shape our work to come. And also just the sheer levels of access. our artist communities who may be far and wide throughout the country that have their own listenership and fan base, who maybe weren't able to come to the Delmarva Peninsula on September, second weekend in September, but now have access to the event. How do we can maintain that level of access in the future? We know that this content is enriching, rewarding, and can and shape a very positive future. So having it limited to these in-person interactions, when we think to the future, there's no reason that we shouldn't be finding ways to make more access virtually.
Well, in terms of going forward, one of the questions, I guess, becomes, and I think you've sort of tried to address it, but what happens if the pandemic continues to be as it is now? Perhaps we might get a second wave. They've talked a great deal about that. And even with vaccines, we're looking at maybe they might be helpful, but that we still may be in a sort of semi-lockdown or at least limited interaction with others. How do you then go forward? Have you guys been thinking about that? What kind of things might you resort to if indeed we are where we are a year from now?
Well, knowing our experience in 2020, that if we are unable to gather in person, that we now have this experience of the virtual celebration and we will learn a lot from it, we know that we can continue to deliver the positive message and content that the festival brings. Not being able to gather in 21 obviously would be very disappointing, but if it's the ultimate reality, I think there's a point where there's acceptance and that you need to be able to create as safe and engaged experiences as we can. It's one of the reasons we're waiting until January to assess what our options are. There's so much that needs to be known about the trajectory of the virus, and it's just too soon to be sort of speculating on the what ifs. So I hate to dodge, but we intentionally left this time to see if things get sorted out a bit and we have a better, cleaner picture of what 21 is going to look like.
Well, let me ask you this. So if we were forced to, say, go virtual again in 2021, what does it mean in terms of Salisbury and its custodianship of the festival? Does it then move on, or what's the thinking there? Because it was for 3 years here, and obviously at the time it was an in-person event. We've now sort of pushed it back so that it will be at least scheduled to be in Salisbury in 2021. But if we wind up being virtual, what does that mean for Salisbury?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, the National, in the way it's designed with a three-year residency and the selection of a new host city, obviously, we've never had an interruption like what we're experiencing here in 2020 and still some uncertainty for 21. We haven't mapped out what would happen if we weren't able to gather again in 21. It would be a conversation with obviously the various leadership teams and the interests of the host community what seems like the best approach. We've been adjusting to the times as we can. The National can be a nimble event to bring to the communities what those communities need at that point in time. And it has been part of trajectories of recovery and resiliency for our host communities before. again, never facing something like what we're going through in 2020. We know that the national can really be a leveraging point for our host community. So I would look forward to talking to the city of Salisbury if we should find ourselves in that place and figure out what is the best path forward. For an event that is celebrating its 80th, we know that we will carry it forward. And with everything, never really seeing something like this in this basically in the American experience, we'll have to look at those questions as they come.
Well, so let's assume that, for instance, we may have the event and so on, and it moves on. Obviously, it's going to move on sometime. So what is then the responsibility of a place like Salisbury to carry on this tradition as it has done in other towns?
Oh, so in the pre-coronavirus
right.
era, the design is that the National is in a host community for 3 years, and then it moves on, and the host community maintains its own traditional arts celebration. For the city of Salisbury, that's been designed as the Maryland Folk Festival. Obviously, the plans for the Maryland Folk Festival are subject to whatever happens with the tenure of the national. But I have not seen any changes of commitment or interest in, again, once it's safe to gather, that an event of this type and scope and cultural impact would not be desirable for Salisbury. So I think it's the coming soon Maryland Folk Festival is something to just know is still what would take place once the National does eventually move to its next host city. We are all a very friendly and a menial group of people who are facing the reality of what's in front of us, and we will just adjust the plans as they need to be for the success of our host community.
So you obviously, as most people know, were as in charge of the Ward Museum. You miss us at all?
Oh, very much so. Not being on the shore during times like this where obviously the access to the natural environment and all the various, beautiful lifeways of the shore has been a change. And my heart does go out and hello to my friends at the Ward Museum of Wildfowl Art, Salisbury University, watching them dealing with their reopening and all of their pivots to the virtual environment. The team under Dr. Kristen Sullivan has been responding tremendously to the challenges of the situation, and they've also been creating some really beautiful programming. So yes, I miss you, and I'm also very proud to see how everyone is, rising to the challenges of this year, and for the ward, how they've been able to really bring an important piece of content with Chesapeake Traditions Today into the National Folk Festival for the virtual celebration.
So are we going to see you back on the shore anytime soon?
I hope so. We're still traveling much, but yeah, as soon as it's the opportunity comes, that would be the plan. At some point, this we'll be able to stand in a room together, Don.
Really?
Maybe.
Well, I have a virtual room in any event, right?
That's right. You guys have a beautiful community, and I know that as this year rolls out, we'll all find ways to connect and try to rebuild the relationships and very impactful work that so many are doing to create strong, healthy communities on the shore.
By the way, just a final question. Is there anything in particular that you miss on the shore?
I joke about this, but not being able to get to a Smith Island cake whenever I want is a challenge. Over here on the Western Shore, even like seafood, you guys probably, I hope, are still having a pretty reliable access to locally sourced seafood. But once you get over here, it's harder. Thinking with my belly,
right.
And of course everyone, my friends and neighbors and colleagues that just when you can walk around a downtown and run into basically, people you've known for decades, that's not really happening right now in quarantine. So.
Well, we wish you the best of luck. We've been talking with Laura Bottinelli. She's the Executive Director of the National Council for the Traditional Arts. Appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us this morning.
Thank you, Don. Take care.
And you too. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Many colleges have reported major spikes in the coronavirus in recent weeks as dorms have reopened and classes have started. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill sent most undergraduates home after clusters popped up in campus housing. Notre Dame delayed in-person classes as students tested positive by the dozens, then the hundreds. Clemson, Baylor, Louisville, and dozens of other Division I universities reported cases in their athletic departments. And at Iowa State, aggressive testing of students moving into dorms turned up scores of cases. The New York Times, August 26, 2020. The data as of August 25, 2020. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. The New York Times reports on August 26 that as colleges and universities open for the fall, data in a survey conducted of more than 1,500 American colleges and universities has revealed at least 26,000 cases since the pandemic began. The Times says this data shows where the virus has been identified over the course of the pandemic, not necessarily where it is prevalent today. The Times has counted more than 20,000 additional cases at colleges since late July. Many of those are new infections from this month, but others may have emerged earlier in the pandemic. Do these numbers indicate that as colleges and universities open for the fall semester, we can expect a spike in the number of cases nationally and particularly in our area here at Salisbury University? My guest today is Adam Wood, a frequent visitor to Delmarva Today. And Adam is here with us to update us on Salisbury University's plans to assure that students, faculty, administrators, and other staff are safe as the university begins its new term. Dr. Wood is the outgoing president of the Faculty Senate at Salisbury, former chair of the Department of English, and past member of the Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure. Dr. Wood, welcome to Delmarva Today.
Pleasure to be here as always.
Well, it's good to have you back again, Adam. Adam, because there is no national tracking system and colleges report differently, these New York Times numbers are not used for comparison purposes among universities, but are reflective of a sudden spike in cases due to the return of students and others to the nation's colleges and universities. In addition, because there is no national plan for combating the virus, colleges and universities are basically on their own to devise and implement plans to keep their students and others safe. Update us, if you would, on SU's plans for welcoming students back to the campus and how these plans may have evolved since we talked a little over a month ago.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been largely the same past month. You know, the university took a couple of different approaches to this. You know, the first one, since most students were not on campus over the summer, was focusing on getting faculty ready to hit the ground running in the fall. And the last numbers I saw, if I remember correctly, was about 25% of us are trying to teach face-to-face. I'm in that group. About 40% or so are doing some sort of hybrid sort of model. And then about a third or so are fully online. Right now, some of these online courses are considered remote, where they're doing it live over Zoom, just like that. You know, I've only had one class this week. We just started this week, and I taught my classes yesterday. But because of some lingering concerns about the numbers of students who have not yet been tested or the results have yet been posted, I decided to have my first opening class over Zoom. I just thought better safe than sorry. So again, I think it's one of these things that you know, the faculty have really been prepared for this. The campus has been set up as safely as it can be. Classrooms are set up socially distanced. You know, one of my bigger classes has 24 students, and I'm in a room that holds 100 and some normally, but the, you know, the seats are spaced 6 feet apart. Everyone's supposed to wear masks and all these things. And so in that sense, there's been, I think, some really good preparation here. Of course, the one complication that we can't factor into thing is how students will behave. You know, we might want to say on the one hand that they're adults and that they should behave like adults, but at the same time, we have to remember they are college students, and college students are going to do what college students do. You know, there's already been, from what I understand, a report of a fairly large party this past weekend. Some students have been cited for being out in places that they shouldn't be. I don't know the specific numbers of that. You know, I don't think that's been released yet. But we recognize that that is really where the challenge is. You know, faculty are being updated the day of, or at least the day before their individual classes, letting us know if students are clear to return or not. But at the same time, we're having issues where things can pop up sort of immediately. You know, I just had a student email me last night that she had just come down with it, or just gotten the test for it, or just gotten the results at least. And so she needed to be, you know, not face-to-face for at least 2 weeks. And so again, you know, this is something that we're just going to have to be watching constantly throughout the semester, making changes. You know, there are some sort of running gambles on how long we're actually going to be able to maintain face-to-face. And again, I think a lot of this, unfortunately, is really put to the students on how they behave when they're outside of the classroom.
Well, how many students, Adam, are currently on campus for in-person instruction, and that would include the number of students living in the dorms right now who have moved into the dorms?
Yeah, I don't have an exact number on that, unfortunately. I tried to get the most recent numbers, but wasn't able to. You know, there are a lot more students who are staying on campus than are taking face-to-face classes. You know, a lot of these students who are in the dorms, their classes are mostly, if not entirely, online. And so again, we've got two different sort of setups here, that the classroom spaces are one place where it's a bit easier to monitor and to enforce distancing and things like that. In the dorms, you know, this is a really difficult thing, that you cannot constantly be watching students and how they interact. You know, dorms are designed for close interaction. And so my guess is that if we do begin to see cases, it will be in the dorms, but we also have to remember a lot of students live off campus where there's even less monitoring. And so again, you know, you think about the party that I mentioned had been busted over the weekend. You know, there's at least 40 some people who are gathered at these parties drinking as college kids do. I'm sure most were not wearing masks. And so again, this is the really complicated thing, is the stuff that we can't really monitor. You know, in the classroom, I can enforce masks. I can enforce social distancing. You know, any number of these sorts of things. Once they are out of the classroom, it becomes a lot tougher to really monitor them.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about that in just a minute, but the students and including faculty and others, admin staff, staff generally, what's the protocol at SU for entering the campus? What do you have to do in order to get on the campus?
Theoretically, everyone has to be tested beforehand, right? And so for a lot of the employees and even for some students, SU set up its own sort of testing center. You know, I was tested on August 14th. They had this big outdoor area. People were lined up 6 feet apart, and you know, you made these appointments and get the Q-tip shoved up your nose. And so there was a, you know, there was a good attempt to at least get all the faculty and staff tested. Those results, the ones that are being done by SU, are being sent to University of Maryland, Baltimore, where they have a medical college there. And so we're getting those tests back pretty quickly, I think usually within 2 to 3 days. So I was tested on Friday, August 14th. And if I remember correctly, it was late Monday after the Monday after that in the afternoon that I got an email saying that I had tested negative. One of the complications is that people who are having their tests done elsewhere need to get that information to campus, right? So as soon as the on-campus tests are done, they're, you know, and the results are returned, they're pretty much instantly updated in the system. I think there is some lag time, unfortunately, with outside tests. I think there are also some students who didn't know that they needed to send these tests in. So testing is the first one, right? In order to come to classes face-to-face, you have to have tested negative. SU has also implemented an app that faculty, staff, and students are supposed to check in on every morning. You report if there's any new symptoms or anything like that, and then it gives you a green light if you're cleared to come to campus. Again, a lot of the trouble with this is that it relies on self-reporting. You know, I've gotten in the habit of just doing it every morning, no matter what day of the week, whether I'm coming to campus or not, just to remind me to do it. But again, the concern is when you have a large student population, will they remember to do it, right? And one of the other complications with that, with self-reporting, is are people going to be honest about things, right? We may feel, you know, oh, well, I my chest is a little tight today, but I don't think it's anything important. So if you say no to that, you could be missing a very important system. We also know just from a lot of the data that younger people do not get the symptoms as bad as older people or people who are at higher risk. And so again, one of the concerns is that students may have symptoms that they don't really recognize as COVID symptoms in that way. But theoretically, so again, everyone is supposed to have showed up with a negative test, and everyone is supposed to be checking in daily. They will also be implementing, from what I understand, sort of random testing, right? Where they will ask, I think this is done predominantly for students, you know, students just kind of randomly on campus, hey, can we give you a COVID test? How successful that will be remains to be seen. You know, I know that there are other institutions that are taking some sort of stronger measures. I think it was the University of Arizona that I heard about that was regularly testing the sewage pipes that flow out of dorm buildings, you know, regularly throughout the day, just to see if there's any COVID showing up there. They may need to implement some stronger policies, some stronger procedures, depending on how things go. You know, unfortunately, I think a lot of it is just kind of seeing what this first week looks like and then going from there. You know, a lot of the schools that you cited in your opening, again, they did open and made it for about a week before they realized that this was just untenable, right? That this was going to be a very serious health crisis. And again, in a lot of these towns where you see that, you also see, I was reading a story just yesterday about mayors, you know, town mayors who are posting on social media photos of, you know, large groups of college kids at bars or at parties. And again, that's where the danger is really going to happen. So I think, unfortunately, we're just going to have to see how this week plays out. And next week, we'll have a much better sense of how effective this really is. And again, you know, I think blaming the students, I seem to put a lot on that. I don't think it's right to blame the students, right? This is what students do. A lot of them said, hey, I want to go back to college. I want to have the college experience. And I understand that completely. The question is for every university, not just here at SU, was that a responsible decision to make, right? I know that we may get to some of the economic issues if students hadn't showed up a little bit later on, but that is really the position that universities are in. Without the students here paying room and board fees, dining hall fees, a lot of those kind of things, universities are taking a massive, massive hit, right? Some of the big universities have a sufficient stockpile of money, but a lot of smaller schools simply do not have that. And so if you don't have students back, it could be catastrophic economically. If you do have the students back, it could be catastrophic in terms of a health crisis. So it's kind of an impossible position to be in, really.
Let me follow up on the protocol, Adam, for just a moment. Is this a form that the students fill out each day? They check a box, or what do they do? And do they take their temperature? What else do they do? So then they hand in this form. Is that what happens?
No, it's an app on the phone, right? So.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm a little behind the times here. I think of checking boxes. I don't think of apps on phones yet, but I need to do that, of course.
No, it's an app on the phone, and again, it asks you, and I would pull it up and read it off to you, but I did it this morning, so it won't let me pull it up again until tomorrow, but asks you 10 or 12 questions. You know, have you been having any new cough? Have you been having any new nausea or diarrhea? Have you been having any new breathing issues? Have you had loss of smell or taste? Things like that. And one does ask if you were running a temperature. All students, faculty, and staff, when I understand, were given these little care packages that included a mask, a couple other things, hand sanitizer, but also included a thermometer. So theoretically, at least, we know that all students have the capacity to do this, to fill up this app. Again, though, one of the concerns is if you don't feel as if you're running a temperature, do you take your temperature? How many students or even faculty and staff are going to be taking their temperature every single morning and self-reporting? Again, there's really not another way to do it without, you know, coming in and taking everybody's temperature forcefully, which you can't really do. And so, again, I think students, faculty, and staff are well-equipped to do this if they are following the policies and procedures and are following CDC, you know, best guidance in terms of social distancing. Again, you know, just being on campus the other day, I saw two students jogging, you know, about a foot away from each other. Neither one of them had masks. Now, hey, maybe they're roommates and they feel comfortable in that way. But again, you just sort of, the concern is that an incident like that could very quickly turn into something much, much worse.
How many cases are you aware that the university has identified so far? Now, I know you've only been for a week or a little more than a week, so this is still fairly early.
Yeah, and a lot of that data has not been released yet because they're still in the process and they're still, you know, collecting a lot of this data. But anecdotally, from what I've heard, there's been about a dozen to 15 cases so far identified. Now, again, I don't know if those are students who were living on campus, students who were living off campus, students who may have taken a test before they showed up and it took a while for the results to get in. But the last numbers that I heard in terms of officially was that we were still below 1%. Right. Now, again, those numbers were numbers that I'd heard. I believe it was Friday, perhaps Saturday. But again, that's before classes started. That's before all of this really started going on. So again, for me, the number to really be looking at is early next week, because if that has gone up considerably, that's when we really need to start thinking about things.
Yeah. So when you say 1%, that's really the positivity rate that you've got right now, 1%. Of those
a little bit below that, yeah
1% of those tested turned out positive, which is a good number, I guess. Anything they're figuring now, aren't they, anything below 5 or 4 is a good number.
Yeah, well, and again, this is one of the tricky things, is that some people say, well, if you get above 5, you're in big trouble, if you get above 10, you're in big trouble, right? And so those numbers are sort of flux. But again, as you pointed out in the opening quote in the New York Times, it's amazing how quickly you can go from 10 cases to 100 cases.
No, yeah.
Depending on what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, this is not something that's a slow spreader. You get a group of people who have it, in a large group of people without face masks, and instantly sort of everybody can have it. And again, a lot of times young people are healthier, so they're carrying it, but they don't even show symptoms. Okay? If you are not feeling any symptoms and you fill out that app, well, that's not as helpful as it seems to be. And so again, it is really touch and go right now. I think for those of us faculty that are teaching face-to-face especially, we're very concerned, right? Again, these students might be healthy, but I'm older and have some health issues, and so I have certain concerns. One thing that I will say that I'm really happy about SU with, that's not really true at some other universities, is that faculty have been given the total choice about whether or not to continue teaching online. So if, for example, next week the numbers go up in a way that I'm not comfortable with, I will, and I hate the idea of doing this, but I will switch my classes to being over Zoom. It's just not worth the risk. But again, I am grateful that they have given faculty the full flexibility for that. That being said, there are a couple of disciplines that face-to-face is much more integral to what they do. We talked about this last time, hard sciences, labs,
right.
But also nursing. And so, you know, some of those programs are much more tied to face-to-face and have a much more difficult time pivoting than I would, for example, teach a literature course.
My grandson is going to back to college in the fall, and he was given a self-testing kit. Is SU providing self-testing kits to students, or are you not using that protocol yet?
No, we have not used that yet. Again, there may be discussions for that. One of the other challenges is that a lot of these materials like this are in very short supply. Most colleges start within sort of a roughly 3-week window, and colleges who ordered it first and ordered it in large bulk. So again, larger universities got the lion's share of a lot of this kind of stuff. So no, other than the thermometer and the testing app right now, the plan, from what I understand, is just this sort of random sampling of catching people on campus and testing them. Again, it is not forced, so people can decline, from what I understand, which is somewhat problematic. But at this point, that seems to be about the best that we can do. And sadly, just hope for the best. It's not a solid plan always, just to hope for the best. But I do believe that SU has done what it can do, realistically. Again, there were some concerns, as I mentioned before, about some student testing not either having been done or having been recorded. That's a little troubling, but I'm hoping that is getting worked out this week, and we'll just have to sort of see.
It's going to be very interesting for you to see what these next 2 weeks are going to bring the university conducts this experiment in a sense of education in the time of COVID-19. I understand that your term for administrative duties, Adam, have now ended, and you are back in the ranks of the classroom. I'm just thinking that it must be incredibly difficult now, because in a classroom, you walk in, you know what to do, you know how to do it, you've done it many times before. Now, am I teaching in person? Am I teaching on Zoom? What in the world am I doing here? And how am I going to get through to these students? So you started off with Zoom with your classes, I think you said. How did that go, and how did you adjust to using the computer to teach your students?
Yeah, I didn't teach at all in the spring semester for my duties as Senate president and department chair. But I'd gotten kind of used to Zoom through the sheer volume of meetings that I'd been to. My first day of class is not too heavy hitting. It's kind of working through the syllabus, course expectations.
What are you teaching, Adam? So give us the context here.
I'm teaching two sections of a general education course called Aspects of the Novel, right? And this is a course almost entirely populated by non-majors. They're taking it for their gen ed lit credit. And so those courses tend to be large. So each one of those has 24 students in it. And so again, that is, sort of the bread and butter of English departments, is first year composition, and sort of introductory literature courses. It's awkward, seeing 24 faces on a small sort of screen is really complicated, particularly if I ask a question and somebody puts their hand up and they have to really, dramatically wave for me to see it in a field of 25 faces. The other class I'm teaching is an upper level course in American novel. And I have 12 students in that. And that was a little bit easier to work. But at the same time, it's a totally different dynamic than being in the classroom. I've been doing this for 14 years now, since grad school. I taught even in grad school before that. and have always had these sort of face-to-face interactions where it's not just seeing a student's face, reading body language, seeing how they react to things, and it's a totally different sort of experience. You know, teaching live over Zoom is closer to face-to-face than fully online. Like fully online classes, for example, would be I would record a lecture and just post it online. Students can look at it whenever they want. All the materials are posted online. And so that takes out really most of the interaction, at least live interaction between faculty and students. You know, I am hoping to meet with my classes face-to-face on Thursday, tomorrow. But again, I've already got one student who has said that she has contracted COVID. So what the reality will be is that there will be some students who probably end up having to Zoom into some of these classes. And again, as we move forward, you know, faculty who are teaching face-to-face are going to be doing it face-to-face and Zoom at the same time in some ways. The classrooms are set up for this, thankfully. But at the same time, it's a different sort of environment. You know, even if you've got a camera on a tripod, it's set to look at about a 6-foot space in a classroom where many of us who teach face-to-face are much more accustomed to moving around as freely as we want to, where now we know we have to stay within that range so students can see us on the Zoom. You know, teaching face-to-face also requires the face mask, which is muffling and, you know, just its own complications.
Are you wearing that the face mask? Are you masked as well?
I am. You know, I'm in my office with the door closed right now.
Oh, that's right. That's
so I have it all off. But anywhere else on campus,
Of course.
Everyone must be masked up. And so, you know, they distributed some masks and, you know, faculty students have gotten their own. But again, you know, teaching face-to-face with somebody in a mask, you're missing a lot of the facial expressions that you're used to getting from students.
No, I was just going to ask, Adam, and we've only got a couple of minutes left. In terms of using the computer and Zoom, are you using PowerPoint at all? What kind of tools are you using in conjunction with Zoom?
Yeah, you know, I think it varies from faculty member to faculty member. But
no, I meant you. How about you personally?
Me personally, I've got some PowerPoints for some sort of, you know, pre-planned lecture ideas or individual moments. But a lot of times, you know, teaching requires sort of being in that moment, right? Being face-to-face and a student asks a question and you very quickly have to respond. And so, you know, Zoom has the capacity for this chalkboard sort of function that you can type in. And so I've been doing that some. I know that in one of the classrooms I teach in, there's a document camera, and so I may just put down a piece of paper and write on that and have it projected.
No, okay.
Because again, the challenge is for the students in the classroom, and increasingly as we move forward, the students who are zooming in, to all be able to see this at once. Again, the challenge with the PowerPoint or the Zoom chalkboard is that that's the bulk of what they can see, right? They can't see me as much anymore. They can only see that. And so there's a lot of having to go back and forth. It's, you know, it's not difficult, but it's a complication that really slows things down.
Well, there's clearly a real.
I'm hoping to get better.
Well, I'm sure you're excellent, and there's clearly a there's clearly a separation with the students very quickly. I would love to take your American novel course. In that course, what is your favorite novel to teach?
In this particular course, it's the American novel from 1895 to about 1945 or 1925. And, you know, there's a couple of them. You know, my personal favorite is Stephen Crane's Maggie, A Girl of the Streets. That's what we open up with. That's just a personal favorite. And I love teaching it. But there's another novel, the second novel that we're doing, the important literary texts, but that are texts that can give us something to talk about given the moment that we're in. You know, I considered doing a class on literature in isolation this semester, but I thought that might be a little bit too depressing. So I'll perhaps bring that up during the next pandemic.
Well, Dr. Wood, thank you very much for joining me this morning on Delmarva Today. And clearly, I hope you'll come back in a month or so and update us again on how Salisbury University plans are working out with the coronavirus, and how your Zoom teaching is going again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.